Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Dry Dock episode 370. If you're listening to this, then hopefully at the time of its release, I'm somewhere in Japan. Don't know exactly where at this point, but there you go. Nonetheless, this month, the questions are taken from more videos because this is a catch-up month, because every month we fall behind by 1 week on the Dry Dock, so at the Patreon Dry Dock. So, with that said, this week the questions are taken from guides 436 and 437 on SMS Kaiser of 1858 and Rey Don Francisco de Assis of 1853, the Wednesday videos on USS the Sullivans and the Battle of the Barents Sea, and the Friday video on the Danube Flotilla of Hungary. Will Pat asks, I've read that the US Navy's 16-inch Mark 13 high-capacity rounds were designed with thicker walls and somewhat less explosive weight in terms of percent than other nations' high-explosive rounds, to be able to penetrate light armour and heavy concrete. I'm curious, with how lightly armoured some of the treaty cruisers were, would the Mark 13 be able to defeat some of the more lightly armoured of them? And if so, with a far larger bursting charge compared to the AP rounds, would a US Navy fast battleship fighting a pack of generic treaty cruisers actually be better off firing their HC rounds? Different navies used different approximate rules of thumb to determine the penetration capability of their non-armor-piercing shell, whether that be high explosive, high capacity, common, whatever you wanted to call it, basically as long as it didn't have some kind of dedicated armor-piercing head, because of course you did have CPC and SAP at a level below AP. Anyway, with that said, the biggest difference usually was whether you had a nose fuse or a base fuse, because of course a nose fuse, it will start to detonate the minute it hits something, so you're relying more on blowing a hole in the target, which of course, you know, most of the explosion is going to be vented out into the air, because, well, that's geometry and physics for you. Whereas a base fuse will in theory allow for a certain amount of penetration before the detonation occurs, but of course if you don't have some kind of armor-piercing cap, you're relying on just the shell body itself, which may or may not be such a brilliant idea, because obviously if it hits solid armor plate, that shell will start to crumple up and may become non-viable or become a low-order explosion before the detonator actually gets round to blowing it up. So with all those caveats in mind, the ranges for, let's call it HE shell penetration, seem to range between 15% and 30%, depending on the type of shell, the type of fuse, and the Navy that's doing the estimation. Obviously, all of this is looking at perpendicular hits, which would give a 16-inch shell a baseline penetration of between 2.4 and 4.8 inches, depending on where along that 15 to 30% of caliber rule it falls. Now, if we assume that the thicker walls and perhaps using a base fuse is going to push it towards the upper end of things, that would give it a penetration of somewhere between, let's say, around 4 to 4.5 inches, which is actually, you know, pushing towards the upper end of a lot of treaty cruisers' protection. Now, granted, some treaty cruisers had more protection than that, and some treaty period cruisers had more protection than that, but again, those are the upper ends. So, in theory, yes, as a baseline, HC rounds from a US 16-inch gun on a fast battleship would potentially be better to use against the lighter protected enemy cruisers of the period, because they would have the penetration, again in theory, to get through any main armor belt they might encounter, but also obviously carrying a lot more explosive than an AP shell could potentially do a lot more damage, especially considering that cruisers tend to be somewhat lighter built than battleships. Of course, exactly which cruiser you're facing and what angle you're firing at them would also make some difference, and you've got to take into account the fact that with your AP shells, against certainly the lighter armoured of the cruisers, assuming that you can identify them as such, you may be risking through and throughs, in which case even a high explosive or HC round that doesn't penetrate all the way but just blows a socking great hole in the side might still be a better choice than an AP round. But you'd have to be very, very careful about selecting your target, because if you get it wrong and you identify an enemy cruiser and you think it's lightly armored but in fact it's fairly heavily armored, well, the HC shells certainly aren't going to do kind things to anywhere that's not the main belt, so you do have that going for you. but your ability to penetrate the main belt may be considerably reduced. Warrant Officer Will asks, a while back, when talking about more ancient vessels, you previously described the Mediterranean as having two kinds of weather, calm and why are you out of your port, you stupid moron? Yet it seems that the latter becomes rarer and rarer as the age of sail drags on, and with the arrival of steam disappears completely from the record. Did the Mediterranean squadron, the Italian Navy, or the French ever encounter heavy storms in the Mediterranean during World War II? Well, it's not so much that the storms disappeared. The storms were, and still are, very much there. It's just that ships' capability of handling them improved dramatically. Now, to be fair, the Romans did have some pretty large, fairly strong ships, but by and large, most Roman shipping was pretty small. And to be fair, during the Age of Sail, most Mediterranean shipping was also quite small. But when it comes specifically to warships, which is kind of the thing that you're getting at, those tended to become much larger and much more strongly built once you got out of the galley stage. And even to a certain extent, the galleys of the medieval period, at least some of them, were considerably larger than the average Roman galley or trireme. And then once you get into the proper Age of Sail, with obviously multi-decked warships, they're much, much bigger and much, much stronger. And then once you get into the Age of Steam and Iron, then they become bigger and stronger still. But the other big factor when it comes to handling Mediterranean storms during the Age of Sail and then the Age of Steam and Steel is the ability to sail partially or wholly against the wind. Because one of the big, big problems with the Mediterranean is that it's a relatively small and confined environment. And if those storms last for a while, which they can, if you are a square sail only vessel, your only real choice, unless you've already found shelter, is to run before the wind in some way, shape or form. You can't really fight or tack against it. And with, again, the relatively close confines of the Mediterranean, that usually means you're going to end up being smashed into something in fairly short order, you know, land masses and the like. Whereas if you were hit by a similar grade of storm in the middle of the Atlantic, even if it lasted for a week, you might not know where you were at the end of it, but there's probably enough ocean for you to just run and run and run and run, and eventually it'll peter out, assuming that your hull stands up to it all. Whereas as the Age of Sail develops and you start to see the use of lateen sails and basically fore and aft sails to enable ships to tack against the wind, in storms it's not the best option, but it's certainly the best of several bad options. And that obviously gives you the ability to either sail crossways across the wind looking for cover as the storm builds, or you've got more directions and freedom of movement against the storm if you get fully caught in it. And that means that you're less likely to just be driven straight onto a shoreline. And of course, once you get to the Age of Steam, you can just sail directly into the wind and at least try and station keep, if nothing else. So the storms are still there, but your ability to fight them has grown. With that said, yes, during World War II, plenty of times all the navies involved encountered heavy storms. And in fact, storms were responsible for the loss of several warships. For example, in the aftermath of the Second Battle of Sirte in March 1942, I believe it was, both navies that were leaving got hit by a really bad Mediterranean storm, and in fact, a couple of Italian destroyers foundered as a result of that. BK Zhong asks, what do you think was the most revolutionary individual vessel in naval history in terms of design concept from the period that the channel covers? There's quite a few potential candidates, but ultimately, after some thought, I think I have to settle on HMS Warrior, because an awful lot of other revolutionary designs, ultimately, you can argue, are a variation on what came before. You know, race-built galleons? Well, here's a galleon, but lower and faster and with more guns. Dreadnought is revolutionary for her time, but ultimately, she is an expansion on a pre-dreadnought. You know, she's bigger, longer, more guns, but all the stuff that she has is already found on other ships. It's just she emphasizes some things and de-emphasizes others. But with Warrior, as opposed to Gloire, Warrior encapsulates an awful lot of things that basically hadn't really been seen before in warships, and even the things that she did have that were previously seen in warships were integrated in such a way as to create a new kind of ship that essentially redefines how you thought of a capital vessel. Because before, obviously, you had unarmored ships, with the exception of Gloire, for a short period, but the general principle of naval warfare was to have lots and lots and lots of guns in capital ship fights, because you wanted to smother your enemy with as much ammunition as humanly possible to try and essentially kill enough of their crew or wound enough of their crew to force them to give up. And obviously you could accentuate that with boarding actions, you could aim at their propulsion systems, i.e. the masts, and latterly on some funnels and steam engines and so forth. But ultimately the objective was to force an enemy to surrender, for the most part, by making it clear that further resistance was not conducive to their continued lifespan. That's ultimately Age of Sail combat. Shells, obviously, big explosions, that accelerates the process. Whereas with the advent of Warrior, yes, steam engines have been around in ships before. Yes, armor has been around in ships before to a certain degree, but not in the way that she integrated them. Yes, you've had iron-hulled ships before, but not an iron-hulled, iron-armored ship. And yes, her design is basically an Orlando-type frigate wrought in iron to a certain degree. But she introduces the idea of the armored citadel. She also, introduces the idea that in future, capital ships' guns are going to have to be predicated more around whether or not they can penetrate the armor of an enemy ship, not so much just sheer numbers or explosive power. And so you go from the previous paradigm, which I described, to this idea of the enemy is protected. We have to be protected against their guns, but also carry our own guns that can penetrate their armor. And that starts an escalating race that completely redefines how you think of naval warfare, because everything now becomes about getting through the enemy's defenses rather than just assuming that you will to some degree or other and focus on wiping out crew. Now it's about blowing holes in the side of the ship and trying to sink it more than it is forcing it to surrender and capture. And that is a fairly revolutionary concept. James Beeching asks, why were the last Spanish ships of the line not built in Havana, where they'd have access to very fine tropical hardwoods that made the Napoleonic-era Spanish ships of the line so good? Unfortunately, although the Havana shipyards were technically still open, the simple fact of the matter was that in the aftermath of the Napoleonic Wars and the Spanish Navy not really building much of anything in the way of large ships of the line, or much of anything in the way of ships at all, although they did build some smaller craft, the Havana shipyards, although they were physically there, had essentially wasted away. They didn't have the manpower, they didn't have the expertise, because obviously as the shipbuilders who knew what they were doing in the 1800s and 1810s retired, there weren't any replacements because there wasn't any demand for their work, or what replacements there were very few of. So by the time it was possible to build the two last Spanish ships of the line, the Havana shipyards simply didn't have the infrastructure, the manpower, or the expertise to do what they'd done so well several decades earlier. Whereas the shipyards in Spain, while they'd barely been in any better state in terms of overall levels of work, they had been able to maintain the Spanish fleet such as it was. And of course, as Spain was much larger in population than Cuba, you could kind of gather up enough shipwrights and so forth for those dockyards. And of course, there was still a degree of commercial shipbuilding going on there as well. So it was just a little bit more viable. The man formerly known as Commenting Is What I Do asks, why didn't the Spanish or the French commit any major naval forces to fighting in the Jacobite rebellions? Surely the opportunity to install a king that would have been more friendly with them, if not outright an outright puppet, would have been worth the effort. So why did they leave the British Catholics near completely unsupported, especially given that only a few decades later they would throw their full support behind the Americans? So why not the Jacobites? A combination of factors. Firstly, while the Stuarts were British Catholics by the time of the Jacobite uprisings, they were still very much British. They might have been friendlier than the Hanoverians to France, particularly, which is where they were chilling out. But the French were incredibly aware that these would still be British kings. You know, the Stuarts hadn't had the best relationship with the French at various points, and that wasn't likely to change. So while it would perhaps mitigate some of the hostility, it wasn't going to get rid of it entirely, at which point you have to, you know, count how much is this actually going to cost you, and is that worth it? Plus, when you look through the multiple Jacobite uprisings or planned uprisings, the French did actually throw a huge amount of military force behind the various attempts. It's just that their various naval invasion fleets tended to come a cropper, either through storms or through, as you can see here, encounters with the Royal Navy, or storms that then led to encounters with the Royal Navy. In fact, the only significant landing of troops they actually ever managed was in Ireland in the late 1600s. I mean, when you look at the sheer number of transport fleets and war fleets that the French assembled, often with tens of thousands of troops on board, and almost all of them end up running into some kind of horrible weather that either sends them running back to France or scatters them, letting the Royal Navy pick them off bit by bit, or means that only little tiny landings here and there take place, you sometimes have to wonder whether the Elizabethans were onto something when they attributed the scattering of the Armada in storms to God, because, oh boy, do so many attempts at invading England in the Age of Sail end up being smashed up by the weather. And so what naval forces the French did commit tended not to have the best time of it. As for whether the French should have then committed full battle fleets to try and challenge the Royal Navy, that just wasn't going to happen. A, you know, putting a fleet of dozens and dozens of ships of the line out to sea on top of the troop transport convoys and the warship escorts that they had would have escalated the cost dramatically. Plus, the preparations for those sailings would have been far more obvious to the British, so they would have had time to marshal their own fleets to counter the enemy sailing. And the risk-reward factor was just, you know, catastrophically off the charts, because worst-case scenario, you deploy a huge amount of your fleet, it gets defeated or destroyed, now the British are right on your doorstep and there's nothing you can do about it. Best-case scenario, you fight through the Royal Navy, you take a dramatic number of losses still, and even assuming that you achieve your objective, you now have a country that absolutely hates the French, a diminished navy, and, you know, given that the Stuarts are being very much opportunists in trying to take back the UK in the first place, there's nothing to stop them going, hang on a minute, let me try and make myself slightly more popular by exploiting the national outrage against the French and building up the Royal Navy to smash what's left of your fleet, because, again, with the British not having to maintain a particularly large army compared to the French, they can afford to divert a lot more of their resources proportionally to the Navy. Almirante Brown asks, Drac, you've mentioned on several occasions that large caliber naval artillery using the Krupp breech block system requires significantly larger turrets compared to non-Krupp systems. What is the largest caliber gun that doesn't use the Krupp system that would fit in the gunhouse of a Panzerschiff triple turret with only minor modifications and therefore be able to replace the 11-inch guns on a one-for-one basis? You can choose any naval gun that was in service at some point between 1900 and 1945. So according to my rough scaling of the barbette's inner diameter, depending on which exact circle you use, you can see the marks in meters there along the bottom. This is Graf Spee's plans, by the way. Once you've converted meters into feet, you end up with a barbette diameter for the gunhouse of around about 30 and a half to 32 feet, depending, as I said, exactly which circle you take. But if we say about 31 feet to be conservative, you actually end up with some quite surprising results. Less surprising, the 12-inch 50 triple turret as found on the Alaska class. That's 30 foot inner diameter. You can therefore lift that 11-inch turret out and pop a triple 12-inch. That probably doesn't come as a huge shock. But the 14-inch 50 triple turret, as found on the Tennessee class, and the 16-inch 45 twin turret, as found on the Colorado class, both have an inner barbette diameter of 31 feet. So it's, okay, weight-wise, it would be hilariously silly, but dimensionally speaking, you could either get a late US standard triple 14 or a twin 16 for the same barbette diameter as was imposed by the triple 11 of the Deutschlands. The earlier triple 14s on things like the Nevada and Pennsylvania classes is actually only 30 feet, so they'd fit even easier. Other alternatives, the twin turret with 14-inch guns from the King George V, that's 29.5 feet. The twin 15-inch 42 from the Royal Navy, that's 30.5 feet. So, yeah, there's a lot of options there. And while it would be frankly hilarious to see a Deutschland waddling around with a pair of Colorado twin 16s stuck on it for, you know, the 5 seconds that will probably last before it turns turtle and becomes the world's weirdest U-boat, in terms of maintaining a triple turret and but upping the firepower by using a non-Krupp breech block system, which apart from gun spacing also means you have to have the shell ejection paths and so on and so forth, in theory, much as you might have to reduce the protection on the gun house itself, in theory you could pop a triple 14 inch on there and have a 614 inch gun ship. Quite why you'd do that, I'm not entirely sure. I'm not sure whether the structure of the Deutschlands could stand up to firing said guns, but from a pure dimensionality perspective, it's possible. Alex Moskowitz asks, how do you plan which shots and from where you're going to take them when touring ships? The simple answer is that in terms of long-term planning, there really isn't much. I mean, I know roughly what the ships look like from outside because, well, I know ships, that's kind of my job, but I don't know precisely how the ships are set up at their docks, and I don't know how much access I'm going to have around and inside them. Obviously, there's a certain amount of indication when I'm arranging to visit in the first place with the people who are there, but what is accessible in the ship, what is safely accessible in the ship, and what they're willing dash able to show me in the ship or around the ship. Essentially, I just kind of go in with the assumption that I will take whatever I'm given. You know, if they want me to stick to the conventional tour route, I'll stick to the conventional tour route. If they're happy to take me down into the bowels of the ship, I'll go into the bowels of the ship. At which point, at least for interior shots, I'm essentially with a mixture of camera and phone camera going, that's interesting, take a photo, that's interesting, take a photo, and basically running as fast as humanly possible with those cameras to get as many interesting shots, of which then I can pick the relevant ones for obviously showing on a video. I mean, I would say probably 20% of the shots that I take are things that are just mainly for my interest rather than anything else. So, for example, obviously this is USS Stewart down in Galveston, and a bunch of the shots that I have are pictures of notices that were taped up in World War II, things like safety precautions for the main reduction gears. Now, if someone asks a question, what are the safety precautions that you need to take with reduction gearing? Now I can tell you verbatim what they are, but for me, that's interesting information for me just generally. For exterior shots, again, I don't know exactly what you can do before I get there, because even if you look at it on Google Street View or Google Earth View or whatever, you can still, well, A, can't account for weather, and B, you are never going to be quite sure, well, can I get that angle? You know, is that private land? Is that accessible land? Is it part of the museum's land? What's in the way, etc. So I just kind of go in a little bit blind and just trust in an eye for camera work and experience to get me the shots that I need. And the same thing when it comes to drone flying. You know, on a long trip, I'll take my drone with me, or one of my drones with me, but I'm never going, and obviously I will try and clear drone flying with the museum in question, but again, a mixture of wind and local regulations and lighting conditions, I can never be entirely sure if I'm going to be able to fly my drone on that particular day or at all. at which point, if I do get the opportunity, I'm just going to be like, okay, great. I'm taking my drone up and I'm going to get as many good shots and videos as I humanly can. And we'll see how that goes. So most of what you're seeing tends to be me going, ah, that looks interesting. Or I wonder if I can get a photo or a video taken from over here. Lessons Learned asks, how many guns are too many guns on a destroyer like the Sullivan's? I know more DACA is always appreciated, but when it comes to weapons like the 5-inch, there must be an upper limit before endurance, especially important for ships deployed to the Pacific, and effectiveness were reached. What would be the theoretical amount of 5-inch weapons you could mount on such a hull before their size, weight, ammo storage, and space would end up crippling the design? Well, congratulations, you've just asked the question most US Navy destroyer designers should have been asking in the late 1930s, because as the US destroyer program had built up speed and tonnages had gradually been creeping up, this whole question of how many guns and how much armament generally do we put on a destroyer was bandied about quite a bit, but the answer always tended to be as much as we think we can physically fit onto it. This turned out to be not such a good idea when it came to ships like the Sims class, which I've pointed out many times before. They essentially launched the thing, got it into commission, and went, that's about as unstable as your average HOA president. Let's bring that back in and take a few bits off. So when they then go on to do the Benson and Gleaves classes, they have two fewer torpedoes than the Sims, but they add a little bit of displacement, and they're kind of just about workable. And then when it comes to the Fletchers, the whole design process is full of people going, yeah, this is great. You know, we're adding around about 400 tons to the displacement of our destroyers. Clearly, that means we can get even more guns on them. So they start talking about 6 single 5-inch guns. They start talking about 15 torpedoes because they've got the quintuple launcher now. And luckily for everybody concerned, some slightly more sensible officers put their foot down and go, no, we've seen where this leads. Stop it. We're keeping the armament of the previous destroyers. That's the Bensons and the Gleaves. So 5 5-inch guns and 10 torpedoes and 2 quintuple launchers. And we're putting that on our bigger hull. We're looking for improvements elsewhere. And as a result, what you get with the Fletchers is that main armament, but a lot more stability, a lot more upgradability, a lot more capability to take things like anti-aircraft guns going forward. So realistically, if you want a good Pacific destroyer, or a good destroyer generally, on around about a 2,000-ton hull, which is what the Fletcher base design is, then, well, 5 5-inch guns is pretty much all you're going to get unless you start sacrificing something else quite significant. You could, for example, argue that perhaps if you sacrificed one of the torpedo launchers, you could get a 6th gun in there, but then you're down to just a single launcher and 5 torpedoes, which, given the profile of a destroyer at the start of World War II, is probably not a brilliant idea. And as long as you stick with single guns, you're also beginning to look at less and less capable arcs of fire. I mean, obviously the 2 fore and 2 aft guns on a Fletcher have good arcs of fire, but already the 5th gun can only fire either broadside. It can't fire directly forward or aft, and anything else you put in is going to have a similar issue. GRLT23 asks, after the Battle of the Barents Sea, Admiral Raeder lost his job, but did any repercussions hit Contra-Admiral Kumetz and Lützow's captain Rudolf Stange? Also, who was in charge of Lützow? I found an opinion that Kumetz was on board Lützow trying to micromanage the ship. Well, whoever told you that last bit was wrong, because, well, Kumetz was on Hipper. That's a fairly established matter of historical record. Whether he was trying to micromanage Hipper is another argument, but he definitely was not on Lützow. Now, as far as repercussions on Kumetz and Stange, or Stanger, maybe, for the Barents Sea, if you look at the arc of their careers, as opposed to very, very detailed German documents, which I don't have immediate access to, it would appear that it's kind of a tale of two very different career paths. Kumetz actually ends up in relatively short order being placed in command of the German Baltic efforts. Now, that is a little bit of a hiding to nothing in the late war, thanks to, you know, the massive Soviet advances. But it is actually also the most active part of the Kriegsmarine's operational areas as far as surface combat goes. So you could argue that he was not particularly affected, because he was then put in charge of, you know, the one place the Kriegsmarine surface units were actively seeing a lot of action in the late stages of the war, even if it was, as I said, a little bit of a poison chalice. Of course, Kumetz didn't have the best luck. Bear in mind, he was aboard Blücher when Oskarsburg Fortress decided he shouldn't be anymore. Nonetheless, I would say that promotion to an operational fighting command isn't a bad outcome for Kumetz. Stange, on the other hand, or Stange, Germans, let me know in the comment below, S-T-A-N-G-E, how would you pronounce it? He does seem to have suffered somewhat, and, well, somewhat understandably, given the complete inaction on part of Lützow. He is promoted, he's not court-martialed and dismissed from service, but when you look at his promotions, he's essentially promoted onto land and remains there for the rest of the war. Now, granted, there aren't a huge number of Kriegsmarine service commands in the late war period, but being promoted to shore duty is, in a lot of navies, especially including World War II, kind of a tacit acknowledgement that we can't get rid of him, but we also don't want him anywhere near a ship anytime soon. See Carlton Wright in the US Navy after the Guadalcanal campaign, for example. PH89787 asks, had someone managed to calm down the moustached one after Barents Sea, could Gneisenau have been repaired, upgraded, worked up and deployed in time to fight alongside Scharnhorst at North Cape? So if we assume that work continues relatively uninterrupted, I would say you probably want at least 2 to 3 months once the ship has been completed to do working up trials, getting the crew familiar or refamiliarized with their ship, testing the guns, etc., etc., all that standard stuff. Now, obviously, for shakedown trials, working up, repair, and necessary repairs and modifications afterwards, normally you'd probably want a bit more, but this is wartime, so that would mean you'd want her out of the dry dock September at some point, probably early September, ideally late August. That means, as of Barents Sea, you're essentially asking, could you have completed Gneisenau's modifications in about 8 months? And the answer is probably not. The estimates for her upgrade, and including the bow replacement and installing all the new 15-inch guns, would run to about 16 months, 16 to 18 months. So you talk about a year and a half, or just under the circumstances they had at Kiel at the time with the workforce they had at the time. In theory, the area where they were upgrading Gneisenau could support efficiently an increased workforce that might cut that time down to around about a year. But that would mean that the upgrade would be either approaching or just about completed right around the time that Scharnhorst is sunk, with no working up, no trial voyage, nothing. It would literally, if you were really lucky, be a case of, theoretically, we can put the ship in the water at the time of North Cape. So, no, in all likelihood, it's not possible. In theory, if you expanded the work crew to the maximum realistic size before they start getting in each other's way, and you devoted a huge amount of resources to Kiel, and you were doing, you know, 3 or 4 shifts working essentially around the clock, then maybe, you know, if you were refitting her at the same kind of speed and intensity that the British built Dreadnought in 1905 and 6, then maybe you could get Gneisenau out of dock and into the water in time for her trials and work up and just about get her to Norway, assuming that you've got enough fuel and so forth for the Battle of North Cape. But that would be extremely unrealistic in, you know, the latter part of World War II for Germany. Twinkie Octopus asks, I found it interesting in the Hungarian video that they said the river boats could either choose to be maneuverable or stay steady on course. Why is that? I believe that's because if you saw especially the second video with the drone footage of the man overboard exercise, the craft, although I don't believe they have bow thrusters, the way the engines and rudders are set up are such that, and as well as the hull, that they are very nice and steady on course. If you just hold the wheel dead ahead, they like going in a straight line. But there's enough play with the rudders and the engines they're powerful enough that if you then choose to put the rudder hard over, you can do some very fancy tight maneuvers with them. So they're actually a really good balance, especially for, a riverine craft primarily designed for minesweeping and self-defense. Sharkman asks, a few questions, a bit more about the video's behind-the-scenes production and logistics. This is the Hungarian flotilla video. Did you have a translator with you at the time, or did the sailors speak their answers in Hungarian for clarity but happen to know English and explain things in casual conversation? Most of the sailors in the flotilla, as far as I understood it, spoke and understood Hungarian pretty much only. I'm fairly sure that they understood a degree of English, but not enough to be conversational in, and certainly not enough to respond in. Some of them could speak English to varying degrees, but as I said, I think the majority of them, they understood some English, but they weren't able to communicate in it. And to be fair, I'm pretty sure everybody on that ship understood more English than I understood Hungarian, but there you go. Luckily, in this case, what I had aboard with me, or who I had aboard with me, was a good friend of mine, Peter Anshan. You may be passingly familiar with him because he's also a very skilled artist and has actually, I've sort of commissioned him and he's done some of the artwork that is available as channel merchandise. But he also happens to be Hungarian and therefore obviously speaks Hungarian, but he spent a reasonable amount of time in the UK and therefore also speaks really good English. And so he was the kind of go-between for arranging all of that in the first place. And then he was kind of there as the live translation service. So I would ask a question. He would then translate it into Hungarian. And then the sailors in question that I was interviewing would reply. And then he would then translate a sort of pricey gist back to me. So I understood roughly what they'd been saying. So I didn't then, ask a question about something that they'd already just mentioned. And so we went back and forth it that way. So I had a basic idea of what had been said, but then afterwards as well, I was able to send him the videos and go, okay, here's what they said. Could you give me a full translated transcription, which he did. And then I used that obviously as the basis for what you heard as the overdubbing in the video itself. And yes, that did mean an awful lot of editing to get the video in the format that it eventually came out in. Billy Joel asks, I'm writing a paper and I'm grasping a little bit at straws. Could you point me in the direction of any sources and or scientific papers about fast battleships and the fast carrier task force of World War II? So for things like this, particularly since we're referencing World War II US Navy, by the sounds of it, with references to the Fast Carrier Task Force, I would tend to follow this structure, which is similar to the structure I follow generally for finding sources for stuff. In this particular case, I would look for published papers by the US Navy War College. Obviously, some of the more modern stuff is restricted, but there are a fair number of papers that various students have published on US fast battleships and the US fast carrier task force over time, and obviously they will tend to be fairly well researched and usually relatively accessible. That's the more the scientific paper side of things as an immediate search. The other thing you can do if you want to track down both primary sources and have access to good secondary sources as well as potentially papers is to identify a handful of good books on the general subject. So perhaps Norman Friedman's US Battleships, or there's two or three good books, including one by Norman Friedman on US carriers. and then look for the section that covers the fast battleships, the fast carriers, look at the sources quoted there, so reference back to its bibliography, and there you'll find reference to other good books, papers, and primary sources, particularly obviously for American stuff. If you have access to NARA, that's quite helpful. And obviously that's your primary sources covered, and the secondary sources that they reference in terms of other papers and other books, you can then follow those rabbit holes and see where they lead to get more specific resources on the ships and the formations that you're looking at. That's kind of my go-to framework generally for finding lots of detailed information. It's a combination of, are there professional organizations who are likely to have published significant papers on them, and whether that's something affiliated with a Navy like the War College or the Navy Record Society or the Society for Nautical Research over here in the UK, if you're looking for British stuff primarily, and then separately look for good quality secondary sources like Friedman's books, Burt's books for the British, Jordan's books for some of the French stuff, etc. Although obviously John Jordan works with various French authors for the French stuff, understandably, and then reference their bibliographies, and that'll help you chase down an awful lot of what you need to find out. Seb Dove asks, the Spitfire of the Seas, what can you tell us about MGB-81 itself and the men who crewed boats like her and the antics they got up to during the Second World War? Well, MGB-81, which has currently been preserved and restored in Portsmouth, and on certain days you can actually ride aboard her, is, as you can probably tell from this picture, really fun to actually ride on. Now, as far as her history, she actually has a three-phase life. She starts life, obviously, as MGB-81, which is what she's been renamed back to now, which is a motor gunboat, so a high-speed powerboat with various types of weaponry on board in terms of firearms. Then she's reclassified as a motor torpedo boat because she's supposed to carry a couple of torpedoes, although it's not entirely clear if she actually ever did, but she probably at least was fitted for them, as well as her gun armament. And then she was sold off at the end of World War II, entering a number of civilian roles, including at one point a smuggling vessel, it appears, before eventually being bought up and restored back to her World War II condition. She saw quite a number of actions, particularly against German coastal convoys and armed trawlers, although also occasionally against Schnellboote. Now, in terms of the people who crewed craft like this and what they got up to, it was a very scrappy affair, all things considered, because they would generally see action somewhat more regularly than most crews on larger warships, because, well, there were an awful lot of MGBs, MTBs, and Schnellboote on the other side, and they tended to deploy, if not necessarily nightly, at least very, very often. And when they did deploy, although obviously there were a fair number of patrols that didn't necessarily come up with anything, there were so many deployments and, as I say, so many craft in such a small area of the sea, basically the Channel and the Southern North Sea, that you'd end up with encounters on a semi-regular basis. And in some ways it demanded a somewhat separate set of skills to most other Royal Navy commands, because when you were engaged in combat, the speed and manoeuvrability of your craft, plus your ability to aim and fire your guns, was absolutely critical to your survival. Plus you might have to be stealthy or cover a friendly craft that had been disabled, or make calculated decisions on how your manoeuvres in the next few seconds might allow you to either put an enemy craft between you and another enemy craft, or perhaps slide between two enemy craft, all sorts of things like that. Whereas by this stage of naval history, even when you're talking about destroyer engagements, everything is a little bit more long-term. So destroyers, cruisers, battleships in general, not all the time, but in general, you are thinking about, okay, well, I'm going to make this maneuver, and in the next few minutes, that will lead to this. So you're concentrating on basically putting your ship in the best gunnery position, trying not to get hit by torpedoes and stuff like that. Whereas in an MGB or an MTB, if you're engaged in a ferocious gunfight at short range with enemy craft of similar or slightly larger displacement, whether you turn to port or starboard in the next 2 seconds, and then 10 seconds after that, whether you change course again, and which of your guns, whether your machine guns, your pom-pom, perhaps your six-pounder, though the MGB-81 doesn't have a six-pounder, but some of them do, which ones you bring to bear and how you maneuver to keep those guns on bearing, as again, within the next few seconds, can make all the difference to your survival. They're also the only branch of the Royal Navy that occasionally actually has boarding actions against enemy warships, because in fights between MTBs and MGBs versus Schnellboote, boarding actions and ramming are, while not common, not exactly unheard of. Capitano Lorenzo asks, how did the Imperial Japanese Navy Sanshiki Type 3 shell actually work? Did it ever knock down any aircraft in combat, and was it used in bombarding Henderson Field? And if so, was it effective? So the way these shells worked was essentially like pretty much most heavy long-range anti-aircraft shells in the era before VT fuses, or proximity fuses more accurately, which was simply a mechanical timer on the fuse that was set just before the shell was fired. The idea being, obviously, you fire the shell at the point in space to which your fire control systems have told you to aim, and then after a certain amount of time, which corresponds hopefully to a certain amount of travel, the shell will explode because the timer runs out. And in this case, instead of conventional anti-aircraft shells of that large caliber, which would scatter a whole bunch of shrapnel around, the Sanshiki shell would scatter a whole bunch of shrapnel, but it would also scatter a whole load of incendiary tubes, which create this big cone of flame. Now, of course, these are most famously used by the Yamato class, but the Japanese actually manufactured them in all sorts of calibers for basically anything that you could conceivably use as a heavy anti-aircraft gun. So, although the Yamatos, as far as I'm aware, aren't known to have actually shot anything down with them, I couldn't for certain say that they didn't shoot anything down, because they would have been expended by a variety of other ships. And ultimately, although the flame wall turned out to be far less effective than was originally conceived, seen more as an interesting pyrotechnics display by most pilots, it was still also chucking out a bunch of shrapnel. So it's possible at some point in the war that some aircraft were downed, most likely by the shrapnel bursts from somebody firing their version of a Sanshiki shell. And as you note, they were used in the bombardment of Henderson Field by the Congo class, using a 14-inch version. And in this role, they were actually pretty effective because, well, scattering a whole bunch of shrapnel around a relatively open airfield with exposed machinery and parked aircraft and canisters of aviation fuel, yeah, that worked. And the incendiaries also worked somewhat better there, because the single biggest problem of using the incendiaries as an anti-aircraft round is that, yes, they might burn with a spectacular flame, and yes, they might burn very hot, but even assuming that they're not just dodged, because the 3D environment makes that relatively easy, even an aircraft flying through, assuming it's a metal-skinned aircraft, is going to be exposed to those flames for a very, very short period of time, and thus is unlikely to be particularly affected unless it ingests a burning thermite stick or something. Much the same way as you can pass your finger through a candle flame quite quickly, but you can't hold it in one. Whereas, obviously, when everything is stationary on the ground, you can have a whole load of burning incendiaries in prolonged contact with stuff, and that does tend to set things on fire quite effectively. Matt Blom asks, what was the first fighter designed specifically for fly-on, fly-off type operations off laptop aircraft carriers, and were any far-reaching lessons learned from its development? An aviation-based historian might be better qualified to give precise details, because for me, trying to work out exactly what's the first fighter designed specifically to fly on and off a ship, well, are you looking at something that is designed specifically for, like you say, flat-top carriers, i.e. that would be a fighter that would be designed to operate with HMS Argus, because she's the first full-length flat-top carrier. But then before Argus, you have things like Furious in her various early iterations, as well as other partial flight deck ships, which could, in theory, accept aircraft back on board as well as flying them off. And one of the big indications of such an aircraft would be the fact it's designed with wheeled landing gear and not with floats or something like that, and it's not designed to be disposable either. So with that rather sort of woolly standard in mind, I would venture that the Beardmore WB-3, as seen here, is probably the first purpose-built carrier-based fighter aircraft. It's a development of the Sopwith Pup, but it features folding wings, folding landing gear, although not landing gear you can fold in flight. It's designed to be folded up so that the along with the wings, the aircraft becomes a lot smaller for storage in a hangar. And being a relatively light biplane of World War I, it also is actually designed with specific gear in mind to allow it to float if it has to go down at sea. And obviously with the wheeled landing gear, it is designed to fly on and off of carriers, as well as RNAS landing sites. There is a limited production run of them, and they do end up being deployed. But I think probably the single biggest takeaway from the aircraft is something that pretty much shows up in almost every conversion of a land-based aircraft to work on carriers, which is that you will lose performance by having to add in all these additional features to make the aircraft more compatible with an aircraft carrier because it adds weight. But beyond that, other than folding wings make storage easier, I'm not entirely aware of particular lessons drawn from this particular aircraft, in part because, of course, what constitutes a carrier and what performance carrier aircraft have is advancing and changing very rapidly during the late 1910s and early 1920s. So outside of very broad lessons like folding wing good, then pretty much everything else that you might learn is going to be obviated very quickly by further advances, including advances that look promising at the time but end up going nowhere, like the idea that you can have a single multi-purpose aircraft that does everything, which does eventually crop back up again at the end of World War II, but it has a few false starts in the interwar period as well. Paul from Chicago asks, how much of the debacle at Third Ypres can be attributed to Jellicoe? I've seen the concern about the U-boat menace combined with mental and moral fatigue causing Jellicoe to support Haig's attack. This seems unduly harsh to me, but I suppose 3 years as the only man on either side who could lose the war in the afternoon takes its toll. Exactly how much and how influential Jellicoe's support was of the 30 offensive varies very much depending on who you read and, well, what they say and what parts of Jellicoe's admonitions they choose to present. You know, some will say he supported the idea, but it's Haig that's pushing it more. Others would have it that the cabinet's undecided, but Jellicoe's intervention is what tips the balance in favour of going ahead with the offensive, and still others will tell you that Jellicoe absolutely insists that the army must capture the submarine bases on the coast, and the only way to do that is by going through Ypres. And obviously he doesn't say you have to go through Ypres, but he says you have to capture the submarine bases, and it just so happens that the only way the army can see to do that is to fight past or through Ypres. And what this all revolves around is what the cabinet was planning. So it seems, again, obviously not a land war historian here, but it seems that the cabinet were planning to spend more time gathering their strength and waiting for American reinforcements to arrive in order to sustain offensives in 1918 rather than launching another attack in late 1917. But Jellicoe then intervenes and basically says, look, there's no point making all these fancy plans for offensives in the spring and summer of 1918, because unless you do something about the U-boats, we're not going to be at war in 1918 because we're going to have run out of food and all sorts of other things. And at the time that he's saying this, which is the early summer of 1917, he is actually correct, assuming losses continue at the rate that they are at that point. Because remember, at this point, Jellicoe knows exactly what the Royal Navy has to work with in terms of its battle fleet, the Grand Fleet, and what it can afford to release for escorts. And much like Admiral King at the beginning of US involvement in World War II, Jellicoe is painfully aware that the Royal Navy does not have enough escort ships, sloops, destroyers, and so forth, which is why he opposes the implementation of the convoy system for so long, because he does have a point that a convoy without adequate or any escort is, yes, slightly less likely to be found by U-boats, but when and if that is found, it's open buffet season. And I said, King faces a similar issue in 1941. He has far too few escorts for all the various tasks that he's being asked to now perform. And so without the convoy system, the losses that the British merchant fleet is sustaining in spring and early summer 1917 are unsustainable. That is a matter of fact. You can look up the statistics. Britain, if those losses had been kept up, would not have been in the war by early 1918. And since at the time there aren't enough escorts to go around, so therefore in Jellicoe's mind you can't implement the convoy system, the only other way, other than hoping that some kind of miracle anti-submarine weapon comes along, which he's not naive enough to expect, the only other way is to cut off the U-boat threat at the source. And while you can't deal with the U-boats in Germany, but you can perhaps cut off the Flanders flotillas and so forth that are operating much closer, and therefore their submarines are able to reach further and operate longer off the British coast and in the Western approaches. And if you can deal with that, that might reduce overall losses to a point where Britain could be in the war the following year. And so what Jellicoe says, based on the information he has at the time, is factually true. The question is, what are you going to do with that information? Now, of course, in the context of the planning session at which he says it, that will in part lead to 30, because it, I would say, probably forces the cabinet's hand, because, well, pretty much what Jellicoe says, there's no point planning for offensives in 1918 if you're going to be out of the war by then. So it becomes a kind of, well, we've got to try something. Of course, as matters shake out through the rest of 1917, the decision to strip the Grand Fleet of a good chunk of its escorts and the arrival of US escorts under Admiral Sims all factor in to allowing the convoy system to be implemented properly, which in turn drops losses. So at that stage, Britain is going to be in the war by 1918 with or without the Ypres offensive in late 1917. But I guess at that point, it was too far along to be called off. Again, not a land-based warfare historian. Also interesting to note, there was a rather major amphibious operation planned to support 3rd Ypres that didn't actually go off, even though they had everything ready for it, mostly because of the delays that the offensive suffered due to weather and so forth. Brian Smith asks, was the term Kido Butai used by the Japanese Navy after Midway, and what term was used by the Japanese fleet during the Philippine Sea and later Gulf battles? Well, Kido Butai is a non-official nomenclature, because technically the attack force at Pearl Harbor and Midway, etc., is the 1st Air Fleet. Kido Butai simply means mobile force, and it's kind of an unofficial nickname to the grouping of Japan's major carriers. Now, technically speaking, for obvious reasons, the 1st Air Fleet is disbanded in the period just after Midway, and although the 1st Air Fleet as an organization is later reconstituted, it's not a grouping of carriers, it's a notional collection of aircraft squadrons. But in terms of Kido Butai as a mobile force of Japanese carriers, outside of various informal uses of the term, it doesn't appear to really come back in vogue after Midway. So, for example, at Philippine Sea, Admiral Zhao's force is the 1st Mobile Fleet, which is similar, but that's its official designation is 1st Mobile Fleet, and by the informal nomenclature, it technically would count as the Kido Butai because it is the grouping of Japan's major carriers at the time. It's just obviously slightly numerically larger, but overall not quite as impressive as the original. So as an informal thing, you could call Azawa's force, at least his carriers at Philippine Sea, aka the Great Mariana's Turkey Shoot, the Kido Butai, but only as kind of a nickname rather than as a, this is what they were called definitely either formally or informally. And at Leyte Gulf, given the size and scale of the Japanese deployments versus the ships they actually had to hand, that's near enough pretty much the combined fleet deploying, even though it's called elements of the combined fleet, but obviously they call it the Northern, Center and Southern forces. But realistically, it's about as close to as a combined fleet sailing for a decisive battle as you're going to get, which kind of tells you something about the state of the Japanese Navy by that point. And finally for this week, Vokir asks, what were the differences between US neutrality in the run-up to American involvement in World War I and World War II? And how did these affect the missions of the British and German navies in securing the Atlantic shipping routes? There were quite major differences. In World War I, prior obviously to the US getting involved, US opinion was split very heavily in multiple directions. There was, of course, a portion of the US population that wanted to get involved in the war on the side of the Allies. There was a pretty large population that just wanted to stay out of it. And there was also a fairly vocal portion that wanted to get involved on the side of the Germans. Now, although the pro-German faction was gradually reduced and the pro-Allied faction increased over the course of the war, in part due to things like the sinking of the Lusitania, the US was, for the most part of World War I, still determined to maintain as much of a sort of true neutral status as possible. And in that vein, they would trade with anyone who showed up. Hence why the German Deutschland submarine was able to make its cargo run, and the US was happy to sell stuff to them. Now, of course, in practice, this meant largely that they were trading with the Allies because the Royal Navy had surface sea dominance. The Germans certainly weren't going to be running any merchant ships or convoys through to the States at any point in the near future. And the US was, as the war went on, perhaps a little less aggressive about claiming true neutral status and therefore the right to trade with the Germans as they had been in previous conflicts, where, for example, in the War of 1812, they'd been absolutely determined to try and trade with France despite the British blockade. Although, again, it must be said that various American crews at the beginning and mid-part of World War I were still exercising neutral rights to thread their way through the British blockade and at least try to trade with the Germans. And so the US's stance, although it had benefits for both sides, compared to its World War II stance, was much better for the Germans because it added various complications to the British, obviously trying not to tick off the US too much, but also trying to enforce its blockade. Plus, it meant that any convoy escort had to be done purely with British assets across the length of the Atlantic, which was stretching things quite a bit, as mentioned earlier in the question about Third Ypres. Whereas in the Second World War, the US was much more openly pro-Allied, although ostensibly neutral, in the run-up, obviously, to December 7th, 1941. So, although technically still neutral, a lot of US actions during the 1939 to 41 period were very obviously pro-Allied. So there were things like orders that said, well, if you as a US merchant ship or warship happen to see a submarine operating near you, then broadcast that information to everybody in the clear. Now, technically speaking, that applied to everybody. So if you saw a British submarine, then the British submarine would get reported as well. But ultimately, the British weren't operating submarines off the US East Coast or in the middle of the Atlantic all that much. And so in practice, it was essentially, if you see a U-boat, tell everyone where it is. And as the strain on the British and Commonwealth navies increased, because obviously they were having to fight alone after the fall of France, and then they also had to fight in the Mediterranean, which was spreading their resources still further, you ended up with what they call neutrality patrols, hence with the picture of USS Texas here, which was basically where the US Navy gradually extended further and further into the Atlantic, essentially saying, these are neutral waters, these are where we want nothing bad to happen, and we're going to enforce the neutrality of these waters with armed patrols. Now, of course, that also included escorting convoys. And again, in practice, theoretically, British and Commonwealth warships wouldn't be welcome in those areas if they were conducting warlike activities. Of course, if they were heading to US ports where they were going to pay large amounts of money to be repaired and refitted, that was another matter. That's purely business. But again, if the Americans are enforcing a sanitized area of the Atlantic, the British and Commonwealth forces have no reason to go there. Whereas for the Germans, who are trying to get as far away from British patrol aircraft and escorts as humanly possible, the Americans gradually extending the neutrality zone further and further east across the Atlantic is obviously very much a pro-Allied and anti-German measure. There's also a certain degree of trailing coats in the water to, you know, dare the Germans to try something which might get the US involved sooner, which does lead to incidents like the torpedoing of the destroyer Reuben James. And that brings us to the end of this week's Dry Dock. Thank you very much, everybody, for listening, and I hope to see you again in another video at some point in the near future. Bye for now.